Kelvin became gradually aware of the chamber's soft blue radiance and the throbbing pain in his temple. St. Helens. The man had treacherously struck him, and he had fallen into the transporter. He checked what was on him. His laser was gone, left where he had foolishly set it down. The gauntlets were also missing, left by the laser. St. Helens must have possession of both. He still had his shield and sword, as befitted a hero of Rudd. As he looked around, he could detect small differences in this almost identical chamber. This had to be in another world than the one of the golden-scaled dragons. This had to be the world where somewhere a king who looked like King Rufert held his father and half-brother in a dungeon. It could also be a world that held Rudd's former queen, just in case she wasn't dead. He rose, stiff, sore, and a little dizzy. There were footprints in the dust that had not been in the other chamber. They led across the chamber to a bluish curtain of light and, not quite to his astonishment, to a large and glowing exit sign. Through the curtain, he could see a rock ledge. Kyan had gone this way, and so must Kelvin. He stepped through the curtain and found himself outside. Not in a subterranean cavern or by a dark river, but all the way outside. Looking back, he saw no sign of a blue shimmering curtain of light. There was only the rock wall of a nearly vertical cliff. A rope ladder led down from a cliff into tree branches. He approached the edge cautiously. He turned back to examine his place of emergence. It looked like blank rock, but when he put his hand out, it passed through. The curtain was an illusion of rock, perfectly concealing its nature. He went to the ladder. Now he saw that the rope was not hemp, but some metallic material that would surely last millennia longer. He grabbed the ladder, got his feet on the rungs, and did not look down. He started climbing down. The branches reached up like hands, though it was just the breeze that made them seem to clutch. His feet found the limb at the end of the final rung, and then he held the ladder, trying to look down through the branches to the still distant ground. He swayed, hung on, and then lowered himself from one branch to a lower one. All he could think of as he descended was how much more confident he would be if he were wearing the gauntlets. His palms never sweated in those. Finally, he reached the ground and stood for a moment, weak with relief. But he still had no clear route to travel. The huge tree stood rooted at the edge of a tangled forest that left no leeway for intruders. He had to scramble just to make progress. The river purled along beside him as he stumbled along looking for a path. Where had Kyan gone? He saw one faint trail, perhaps made by Mir or some other ruminants. He directed his steps that way, wanting to sit down, feeling he might fall, but willing himself to be brave and durable. Those three silver spirals he had seen through Helen's eyes on their astral trip. The tree was close enough, and his time was not pressed. He could afford an inspection. He walked over and found the chimes within reach. They did appear to be snakeskins with scale patterns, but the material was of a light metal, silver in thin belts resembling the skin shed by snakes. He drew his sword, cut through the leather thong holding a chime, and caught the silver trinket as it fell. He compressed the spiral flat and found it held its new shape. He slipped it into a back pocket of his pantaloons and walked on. A mountain path lay ahead, a real one, not a mere animal trail. It seemed similar to a path he and John once trod in Dragon Country. No dragons here, he hoped. If there were, it was going to take more than one silent silver chime to save his unheroic self. He noticed a growing weakness. He had been growing weaker since taking the chime. Could there be some magic connected with the things? He progressed only a little way up the path when dizziness and weakness overwhelmed him. His knees buckled as his legs turned limp and folded. His head buzzed like a nest of hornies. Horses came around the bend, and he got a look at a rough-looking, ill-clad man on a horse, followed by at least two others similarly clad. The horse was black as the man's black hair, Something about the combination bothered him. The face looking down at him had a smooth cheek. Otherwise, it was the same. Exactly the same.
Jack! Cheeky Jack! Outlaw villain of the Badlands!
Kyan felt the bump on his head with his fingers as Goethe reached out a finger covered with ointment and motioned his hand away. He sat up, realizing fully for the first time he was in bed. It was, he guessed, the same bed his father had occupied, and his nurse was now Kyan's. It was the room where he had come in astral form.
Goethe! Goethe!
You know my name. Explain.
I was here before. I am Kyan Knight. You put me in a serpent.
That was my cousin Herzig who put you in a serpent, ancestor. You may wish you had remained.
I come from another world, Goethe, as does my father. That's why I'm here. I came to take him home.
John Knight, your father?
Yes, you cared for him. Maybe saved his life.
Goethe stared full in his face. He froze as though from the paralyzing stare of a serpent. Not for nothing were they called the Serpent People.
Now, Kyan Knight, we see if you lie to Goethe. Maybe you think Goethe dumb. Maybe you think all serpent people ignorant.
He wanted to respond, to give her some reassurance, but he could not. He was unable to move. Her hands cupped his face. Her pupil-less eyes stared into his and melted into a blue sea. He felt her coming in and knew that he was more truly naked than he had ever been before. She pulled back, startling him. He felt a weakness spread through him. Her gaze, and still he remained paralyzed. Goethe went to the door of the cottage.
Get Herzig! Hurry! Herzig will have to see this. As leader of our people, he must decide what to do about it.
Herzig came in and walked to the bed, his body rolling in the manner of a flop ear.
You must see Herzig.
The cousin leader held Kyan's face. His eyes shone black. They seemed to sizzle as something happened in them. Kyan was reminded of the void of the flaw. Then Herzig frowned, puzzled, and turned to Goethe.
It is as he said. They are from the other place. They have no magic themselves, but they use what magic comes. The dragonberries, the gauntlets, the Muvar weapon that stopped but did no harm.
The weapon lies in an ancestor tunnel dropped there by the short-legged one.
Yes, this one does not know which tunnel.
You seem hesitant, Herzig.
I am. I wonder what Roforth will want to do when he learns of the place from this one's father. Will he want to go there as a conqueror?
You know Roforth better than I.
Can serpent people know mortals? Even such mortals as this? Perhaps with the gaze we can.
You would gaze into Roforth's murky mind.
I must. Only then can I learn what he truly intends. Only then can I know if we must break the alliance.
If he wants to conquer this world and others...
Then we must withdraw ourselves. Serpent people cannot long leave these mountains, let alone this world.
Will Muvar interfere, cousin?
He will if Roforth conquers. We must not go against Muvar. His race has magic even stronger than ours, and unlike ours, he is not bound to one world in one frame.
Do you think Roforth can be overthrown by his people? Replaced, as you replaced Dunzig as our leader?
Not if we give him all our help, but maybe we do not have to. You and I will take Roforth a present.
Kyan?
Yes. He will have understood little, but it is best that he now forget. He will be our present to Roforth, and he will remember nothing of what has been said.
Kyan's brother.
The words were directed to a large man whom Kelvin could not see clearly.
You ill? You appear unwell.
Oh, hit with fist. Walked far in sun, dizzy.
Yes, I know the feeling. They call me Smoothie Jack. Your brother told us about you. You don't look much like a hero.
I'm not. Not here.
In your own world, you are.
I had to be.
Maybe here also.
Jack moved his hand to his brow, pushing back a sweep of long hair. Naked ears were revealed as round as Kelvin's own.
You! You're a around here?
Most people are in this world. Kayan told us that in your world, it's pointed ears that are the norm.
Yes.
We'll take you to our camp in the Barrens, Calvin. We have medicine there, and you can rest and recover. Can you ride?
Yeah, I can try.
He struggled to stand, felt dizzy, and gave up the effort.
Biscuit, get him on a horse. Tie him on.
You had enough of foreigners. His brother got most of us killed. I say we leave him here.
Matt, you and I have never fought each other. You have accepted me as leader and have done what I said.
That's not changed. Just want you to know how I feel.
He dismounted, picked Kelvin up, and slung him across the saddle. Kelvin felt himself being tied by his arms and legs. Then the big man mounted behind him.
Ready, Matt?
Ready, Chief.
Let's ride.
After what seemed an infinite number of jolts, Kelvin realized that he was seeing sand passing beneath his eyes and that he had been regularly lapsing in and out of consciousness. Sometime after that, he felt himself lifted from the horse.
He does look pretty bad. I wonder why. That little bruise on his face can't account for it.
Maybe poison.
Maybe. Hey, fellow, you eat or drink anything since you arrived here?
Nothing at all. Maybe that's why I'm so weak.
You bitten or stung anywhere?
No, nothing like that.
We'll have Hito check him. He knows more medicine than the rest of us.
Hopeless. Some savior. Worse than the other.
Easy, Biscuit. It's not his fault.
Kelvin felt himself carried. A tent flap brushed his face, and then there was the rough texture of a bearver hide under him. He concentrated on seeing, and what he saw was a small man with a wide mouth. The face familiar. Hideously familiar.
Hey, son, it's just Hito. He's a dwarf, not a flop ear.
Kelvin's vocal cords strained so hard they were refusing to work. He needed to say something, but he didn't know what. The dwarf was staring in his face, making soothing motions.
I'm Hito. You're Kelvin, Kayan's brother.
Yes.
There's something the matter with you. Maybe I can help.
No! Where's Kayan? Where's my brother?
He's dead. Swallowed by a serpent.
We can't know that for certain. What do you think, Hito? What's killing him?
What hurts most, Kelvin? Tell us.
Back pocket. Pantaloons.
Let's see.
Biscuit's big, rough hand lifted him and felt.
There's something here, all right. I'll take it out and we'll have a look.
Kelvin felt as if the chime had grown a serpent mouth and sunk its fangs into him. Then he felt the fangs pulled away.
Gods, look at this. Talk about your lack of sense, dumb foreigner.
He didn't know.
Poor man, not to beware of magic.
He'll die with the sun, like a snake's tail at sundown. When the sun goes, so does he.
Poor man.
I've heard of something. I don't know if it's true, but I've heard that if the chime is taken back to its tree and properly hung there before nightfall, the victim lives.
A wives' tale.
But maybe true. It does make sense, because the point of a curse is to prevent molestation of the thing it guards. Well, that's no good if people steal chimes and then throw them away or sell them when they get sick. You've heard the legends, Hito?
No, Master. I've never heard of a chime being taken.
Nor I, but it could be. Since it's our only hope, we'd better try. Kelvin, where did you get this?
I found it in a big O-apple. Three together. I only took one. Near the river before the mountain.
Three chimes together. Big O-apple. Mountain. I know that place. It's too far.
Maybe not, Master. Maybe if I ride your horse...
You, Hito, alone?
I'm light, Master. Your horse can carry me faster than anybody.
But, Hito, to get there before night, you'd have to start now and ride hard all the way.
I will, Master. And I'll rest and feed the horse before starting back.
I guess you have to try. I guess we all do. But it may not save him, even if you get there in time.
As you say, Master, we all have to try.
If the idea is to save him so he can save Hud from King Rofurth, I say don't ride. Save yourself, Hito, for something important that can work out.
You're a skeptic, Matt, but come along and help me get him started.
The sun perched at the top of the mountain as Hito rode Betts down the ridge. He had spotted the two spirals and the big O-apple from above, the sun glancing from the twin spirals in bright flashes.
Please hold back, son. Please.
Deaf to his plea, the sun moved into hiding, sending a dark shadow creeping relentlessly down the mountain at his back.
Please let me save him. Please let me save us all.
The sun hung as but a crescent at the top of the ridge, letting no more than a fingernail of light escape. The tree stood almost shadowed, but stood where it caught the last of the rays. Urging Betts nearer with sharp jabs of his heels, Hito continued to pray.
Sunlight, stay! Sunlight, stay!
He stood up on the saddle, swaying, almost overbalancing, as he grabbed the limb. Quickly, with his free hand, he wrapped the leather thong, tied it, and fell free of the limb and the horse. Had he succeeded? Had he done right? Had he done anything? The last glint of sunlight fell into dark. Kayan was surprised when Goethe and Herzig returned to him as soon as he had eaten.
Kayan, do you wish to be with your father?
Yes.
Then the three of us will leave immediately for Hud's capital. Do you feel you can walk?
Yes.
You look troubled, Kayan.
There's someone else. Someone who is with me underground.
I wouldn't fear for her. She will survive.
But...
A little magic, mortal. Magic spells can protect anyone we choose from the ancestors.
The ancestors? You mean the serpents?
That is what we call them among ourselves. We believe that our people descended from serpents, while yours descended from apes.
We will go then, walking as is our way.
At the end of the second day, they had left the mountains and paralleled the river. The big O-apple with the three silver chimes Kayan remembered was somehow a welcome sight.
You remember being in a chime?
Well, I remember everything until after I was part of a serpent, and then my memories are blurred.
That's because serpents have simple minds. You were becoming part of the mind you were in.
But that serpent was dead, or had been. We killed it with the spear. How could it have a mind?
It was not dead, only badly hurt. We tended to its body and healed it to the extent we were able. Then we put your mind in it, and the other, and you revived its mind as a new spark revives an old fire.
What would have happened to me and Lonnie?
You would have been absorbed. Generations from now, you might have been part of a new, intelligent serpent, or you might not. We serpent people have much magic, but we do not know all there is to know about the life force. There are mysteries even our wisest members have not penetrated.
When I was in astral form, I was me, as alive and conscious of being alive as I had ever been. Yet in the serpent...
In the serpent, you were changing, becoming more like the body you inhabited, but not entirely. This is why we put you there. We knew you would enhance the serpent after it had lost so much of its own mind. Whether you would pull it up beyond its natural level, we could not judge. But certainly you would help it.
Yet I felt as if I had a body when I was astral, and in the serpent too, in different form. Nothing that hurt or could move objects, but a body. When Lonnie and I...
That we think is mainly illusion. You're accustomed to a body. So you think of yourself as having a body. But then our spirits simply return to the serpent ancestors voluntarily and are absorbed into them. Your spirits, who can say?
Not I.
The capital, when they arrived, looked as he remembered. So too the palace. He would feel right at home here. But Herzig was speaking to a servitor, and then two palace guards escorted him away from the Flopears and toward... He recognized this route. Toward the dungeon. Dank, dusty dungeon smells assailed his nostrils. Oh, this was going to be fun. Just as back home. Only here it was he and his father, rather than his father and brother imprisoned. Light coming down from a high barred window revealed the ugly cells. In the first cell, a battered and obviously injured smith one of Jack's crossbowmen he recognized, but did not know very well. In the second cell sat a tall, haggard man who looked at him with wide-eyed recognition.
Father!
Kyan!
The guard unlocked the door and pushed him inside the cell and into his father's arms. Herzig watched with Goethe, his misgivings rampant, as the soldiers took a dazed Kyan to join his father. They stood on the palace grounds, their firm legs supporting them with customary indifference. Soon they'd be ushered into the palace itself and have their audience with King Hroforth.
Cousin Herzig, will they put them together?
Almost certainly, Goethe. So they can talk, and a guard can spy on them and listen. So that father can be tortured before son, or son before father.
Are they really that cruel, cousin?
Hroforth has been in the past. Danzig should have known, but Danzig was cruel himself. If the king knew all our mind abilities, he'd want us to get the information. Only Hroforth is so cruel that he would probably torture them anyway.
I am glad we are not mortals.
The servitor from the palace approached, his manner solemn and purposeful, as befitted his position.
You may come. His Majesty will see you now.
They followed the man as he strode off. They arrived in a great audience room, empty except for Hroforth on his throne. They approached him slowly, inclined their heads, as was the custom, and waited.
Welcome, friend serpent people. I am pleased at your gift of the stranger mortal, and now bid you welcome to Hud's royal palace.
Thank you, Your Highness. We are honored to be here in your presence.
And this is your wife?
Cousin. She nursed both the stranger mortals and restored them to health.
Ah. And can she perhaps reveal things that they have said?
Your Majesty, I spoke to them only as needed. What you would be interested in, military secrets and affairs of state, was not discussed.
Pity. I suspect we shall need to make plans. Aerotax, our neighboring kingdom, is becoming quite vexing to me. I plan on taking over that throne, and I believe you might occupy it for me.
Well, I'm afraid, Your Majesty, that serpent people have no wish to govern mortals. That, Your Majesty, is your responsibility.
Yes. But surely you will want something. Danzig did.
Danzig and I were not directly related, nor did we always bask in the same light. He wished power over mortals for himself and for the serpent people. His wish for power drove him to make the alliance. One mortal sacrifice a year, he decreed, given freely by Your Majesty. In return, we would freeze with the serpent stare any enemy who opposed you.
You are bound by Danzig's word.
I am bound.
But now you do not wish to rule mortals?
I never have wished that, nor have most of the serpent people.
You would have wealth.
Well, we have wealth already.
Then, aside from the sacrifice and the goods delivered to your valley, only friendship?
That is sufficient.
I see. But perhaps in the future.
Possibly. But for now, only friendship.
Good. When you want something, you will ask.
Yes.
Tomorrow we will talk further of my plans. For now, you and your lovely cousin enjoy the palace grounds, the fruits of its orchards, the shade of its trees. When you get ready to leave, I will bestow on you a scrumptiously outfitted carriage, horse, and driver.
Oh, thank you, Your Majesty. But my people prefer to use only their own legs. We allow ourselves to be carried but seldom, and then only for pressing reason.
Ah, I see. Whatever you wish during your stay, simply ask it of a servant. Any special foods, drinks, entertainment, anything at all that you desire. The dungeon where the stranger mortals are now will be locked and guarded, but if you wish, you may tour.
Oh, no need, Your Majesty. One dungeon is like another, and the fate of the mortals does not concern the serpent people.
Enjoy your stay, then.
That night, Herzig slipped from his bed, dressed, and rapped lightly on the adjoining door. Goethe joined him in a moment, looking to his eyes as though she had never slept.
Be ready with the serpent stare. Even this late at night, there may be servitors, even guards.
She nodded, and together they left their room and climbed the stairs. They were almost to the king's chambers when, by a shaft of moonlight coming through a window, they saw a tall woman approaching in a filmy white gown. The woman had red hair and green eyes, and neither of them had encountered her before. Yet there could be no doubt who she was. The queen. Herzig debated the matter only briefly. Then he used his stare to intercept the queen. They could not afford to have her spying on them. It would be a simple matter to cause her to forget that she had seen them. She froze. Then it occurred to him that the queen could be a source of useful information. Should he take the time and energy to read her? He hesitated but a moment. Then, standing on tiptoe, he cupped her chin in his hands, tipped her head forward, and probed deep into her glassy eyes. It was a shock. He had gotten much more information than expected. He withdrew, shaken. He turned to his cousin, controlling himself as well as he could.
We will not need to go on to the king's chambers. He is asleep there with another woman. He taunts his virtuous queen constantly with his infidelities and the evil he does. He is the most evil of all evil mortals. There is no need to awaken him, for I have found what he intends.
He intends to conquer
everything, even our valley. Every land that he and his armies can reach, the stars themselves he would conquer. Only death or displacement will cause him to stop conquering. And the queen has a father we must now go to see.
The queen?
As good a mortal as the king is bad. She will remember nothing of our meeting. Nightly she prowls these hallways, clutching her agony inside. Come!
He motioned Goethe back into a doorway in shadow, then snapped his fingers. Immediately the queen stirred, walking on, her mind, he knew, in a quandary as she contemplated again the evil of her husband. They walked down the stairs, and then via another passage to another set of stairs. They climbed the stairs in the dark, opened a door, and stood in the tower chamber of Zoltanus, aged sorcerer. A high window let in only a little moonlight and starlight, but a serpent person's eyesight was such that it required little in the way of luminescence. Herzig walked to the big bed where the old magician lay sleeping. Gently, very gently, he awakened the man.
Floppier?
Correct, Zoltanus.
Why?
Because you may be able to help. You want to free your daughter of her marriage and your land of its tyrant. I know. I have looked into your daughter's mind, though she and the king must never know of this. There are mortals in the kingdom of Hud who would battle the soldiery and free the land, but they will need help. We serpent people, wily as serpents all, would break our alliance with your king.
Why?
I am the ruler of our people. I know that following your king would mean disaster for us. In other worlds, nearly identical with ours, our people did not long coexist with mortals. Only separately can our people survive and prosper.
What would you have me do?
Be ready to help the strangers to this world who will try to help other mortals overthrow your king. We serpent people are bound by an unwise covenant to aid your king, but it is a covenant I wish to have broken.
But if you give aid, the king wins. Mortals can't fight your kind.
No, they cannot. But neither must serpent people fight mortals.
I'm not certain I understand.
Nor is that necessary. You have been dreaming, but you will think on what you dreamed. When the time comes, you will use your strength and your magic. For now, sleep.
Obediently, Zoltanus closed his eyes. Silently, Herzig and Goethe stole down the stairs and tiptoed softly to their own rooms and beds. For 3 days, Herzig and Goethe remained at the palace, nominally enjoying the hospitality of the king, but actually studying every aspect of his government. They were aware when the king and his trusted brutish guard went to the dungeon to threaten the prisoners John Knight and Kyan Knight by torturing their wounded companion, but did not interfere, because that would have revealed both their knowledge and their sentiments. But Goethe grew shocked and furious.
They have a baby, ancestor. How did that happen?
One of the king's men must have found it strayed from its nest and trapped it in the bottle. to force it to feed on mortal brains. This is shameful abuse of an ancestor. But we must not interfere. The serpent will have to fend for itself. Perhaps when it escapes, we can intercept it and try to ameliorate the bad food before it becomes too negative.
We must keep alert. What an outrage!
But the little serpent was slow to emerge, and 2 days later it was time for them to depart without having had the chance to help it. Depressed, they departed the grim palace. On the walk back, they were to pass a big o-apple with 3 chimes, but as they approached it, Hrsik saw that there were but 2.
A mortal has been here and taken a sacred skin. It is another outrage. Whoever that mortal is, he will surely die.
Yes, cousin. But if that mortal is one who should live, perhaps a stranger from another world who would not know of the curse.
Uncaution brings death. It has always been so. It would be an insane universe were it otherwise. But perhaps it needn't be.
How?
I will think, project my thought as well as I can. The talisman must be returned by the thief before night.
But if the thief is already too weak, too far away?
I will project as well as I can. With the ancestors' help, it may be possible. We must conceal ourselves and wait.
That's good.
He began thinking, projecting outward the tale that no mortal had heard from another mortal for longer than any had lived, with the single exception of Zotanus. The way to avoid dying at sundown was to replace the talisman. He sent the thought out, following the faint astral spore left by the thief, out across the rough country and into the barrens where only the bandits and the true patriots went. Out too far for a dying man to return to, but a thought could be directed at more than one fading life. It could be directed to anyone near. Hrsik projected at the main silver thief who had come time after time to their valley, the leader of the mortals who had attacked Rofith's men. For a long, long time, he projected. But though he knew the thought was received, the bandit leader did not come. The minds of mortals were so frustratingly limited. Still, he waited, knowing that leaders sometimes sent others to do their bidding. As the sun crept below the ridge and out of sight below the far horizon of the barrens, a rider approached on horseback. It was the small mortal who in stature resembled the serpent people. They waited until he returned the talisman. Then, as the small mortal rubbed down his sweaty horse, then, and only then, did Hrsik stretch out his hand. From his fingers, an energy bolt of astral matter traveled as swiftly as only such energy could. The small mortal turned to look, his face surprised by the sound coming, without being evoked by a breeze.
Thank you. Thank you for helping us. For helping all of us.
Concealed by the shadow on the mountain, Hrsik had to wonder what, if anything, the small mortal sensed. But more important, why had Goethe attuned to this particular mortal? The absent one who thieved the chime? She might not be sure herself, but surely it was important. Helm rode Corey's horse out of the brush and waved at the Crumbs and John on the opposite side of the river. John was, as Helm had known she would be, the first to greet her on the proper side of the border.
You all right, Helm?
Couldn't be better.
I didn't know you could ride like that. And those gauntlets. And that dress.
I'll tell you about it on the way to the capital.
The capital? Why? What for? And where's your old man? Where's St. Helens?
That's why we're going to the capital. I'll tell you while we ride.
And she did as they rode back the way they had all come, and then on the main road for the capital and Rudd's new palace.
You're certain he's a prisoner?
He has to be. I'm worried about him. He was still unconscious, and that Melba is such a terrible person.
Terrible, all right. Best thing to do with a witch is to burn her. Once they're burned up, they don't come back.
Yet these gauntlets made me leave him there, and his sword. They almost seemed to put words in my mouth, making me sound like a warrior woman.
She had not told them about the way the men watched her climb down the tree, but probably they guessed. Yet, as it turned out, that ugly business helped her gain the upper hand. The gauntlets really did seem to know what they were doing, and could be quite devious on occasion.
Why didn't we just ride on in and get him? We're Rudd citizens. We might even have gotten there before they got him down from the tree.
No, not a chance. We weren't that far from the Aratek's palace. I don't think our being Rudd citizens would bother Melba, though Philip might be a different matter.
King Rufert may not want to send soldiers. He's cautious about starting a war, and not just because of Melba.
Have we any choice? They kidnapped me, and now they hold my father. Rudd can't allow its citizens to be kidnapped and taken to Aratax and imprisoned. They made the mistake, not we.
But could we win against them? From what you said about Melba...
Yes, Melba is powerful, but we've got something Aratax doesn't have. We've got Kelvin. Where is he, anyway?
He's not come back.
But Father's back. And he had that flying belt and the gauntlets and Kelvin's laser.
Whoa!
Mor pulled his horse to a halt, signaling the others to do the same. Rudd's shining new palace stood in sight, complete with observation tower and newly planted orchards. But this was not why he stopped.
Excuse me, lasses and son, but old Mor smells a rodent on the dinner table, and he thinks it's St. Helens.
What? What do you mean?
He came back. Your husband didn't. He had the weapons Kelvin was going to use to rescue his father and his brother and possibly another person I'm not about to mention. That sound right to you?
No, but he must have had a reason.
Who had a reason? St. Helens or your husband?
Oh, Helen, you're losing your color.
Grab her quick, she's going to fall.
Things went gray. She felt herself sliding and then, with no transition she could detect, she lay on her back and looked up into the face of a man she hadn't seen before. He was bearded, and it seemed to her that he was someone in a thinking profession. Over his slight shoulder, she saw John gazing anxiously at her, holding her gauntlets.
Who are you?
I am Dr. Lennox Sterk, personal physician to His Royal Majesty King Rufert of Rod. You shouldn't have ridden so far so hard, young lady. Not in your condition.
What do you mean in my condition?
You are with child.
I'll be all right. The baby? It wasn't hurt?
No, your baby should be fine, but that foolish dress and that collection of bruises on you indicate that you haven't been careful. You have to start eating right and resting.
What I need is to swallow a couple of dragonberries.
The doctor looked horrified. Hastily, she explained about the dragonberries' effect on her.
So you see, I have to check on Kelvin. I have to know that he's all right.
I am afraid, young lady, I can't allow that.
You can't, but I can.
Helen, you better think about this. You know what a hero Kelvin is. Only Randius can follow him to where he is now. And that means either you or your father.
Yes, you're right, John. I can go as I am without going astral. That's what I need to do. Oh, John, thank you. Thank you for telling me the way.
But that's not what I meant at all. Tell her, Doctor. Tell her she can't go into another world frame in either form.
Well said. Young lady, if you'd keep your baby and want it born strong, you'll do what I say.
But Kelvin!
Will have to take care of himself. He's done it before.
But Father left him. He came back with the gauntlets only Round Ears can use and the laser Kelvin had from his father and the war and that belt.
We'll have to ask your father.
Father, but he is an Aratex. Maybe in a dungeon.
Yes. Lester and Mor are taking steps. They're in audience with King Rufert.
Helen sat up. In that instant, she discovered she sat in a big four-poster bed in a large bedroom with ornate statuary all around. They had brought her inside the palace.
John, how long was I unconscious?
Hardly any time. Lester carried you right in the main entrance. I think the gauntlets kept up your strength until you got here. And then they did something to your nerves that made you faint. Helen, you need to rest.
Piffle.
For the baby's sake.
Damn.
It's all right. Come in.
Lester entered, looked at Helen in the bed, looked at the doctor, and looked at his wife. Evidently, he had not received the news.
She's with child.
Congratulations! Kelvin is going to be so happy.
Well, I'm not happy about it. Not now. I want to know about Kelvin and Kyan and his father and my father and Aratex.
Well, you certainly can't take any dragonberries now. They bring you too close to death. And what would they do to your child? Especially if your child happens to be a point ear, as it could be.
Helen hadn't thought of that. One of her parents and one of Kelvin's were point ears. It was certainly possible.
So she can't go near those berries, can she, Doctor?
No.
I'd take them for you if I could, but you round ears are the only ones who can take them. If I tried, I'd get sick.
You'd die. Any normal pointed person would. Apologies, Mrs. Huckleberry. It may be otherwise in other universes. All it means in ours is that here you round ears are in this way blessed.
Blessed by Muvar, I suspect. But even Helen gets weak after astro trips. It takes a lot of energy from her.
What was King Rufus' answer?
He's sending a delegation to Aratex. My father and I are going along.
I suppose that means I have to stay.
Right. You and Helen, you two hold the palace until we return with St. Helens.
If you mean.
Right again, wifey dear. There may not be a fight, you know. We may just get to King Philip without difficulty.
Moore and Lester rode at the head of the column of hand-picked troops with General Brockner. It had been determined that a show of force would be best.
So what do you think, Dad?
Gods, son, how do I know? If that Philip has the brains of a crawling loose-tick, he'll keep Melba on leash. He can't really want war with us. Besides, he can't know that Kelvin isn't along.
You think we'll just ride in, with no fighting, and then out again with St. Helens?
Out again anyway, I'd think. But I don't think it's fighting we need to worry about.
You mean Melba and her magic?
Of course.
What are you two talking about?
General Brockner jockeyed his horse near.
Just speculating on Melba.
It was a wise plan. If Philip lets her at us, we'll demand her head.
That'll stop her?
Gods, yes. She's not that powerful. If she turns on a big blow, we'll just squat down and wait it out. None of us will be flying like St. Helens. I could have advised him against that. Magic is bad enough, but when you pretend to understand it and call it science, it's worse.
It is untrustworthy.
Right. Look at all the trouble it caused at the Rudd Palace.
We don't know it was John Knight's lasers that caused that destruction, but it probably helped.
I just hope he burned up Rudd's former queen with it. Personally, I doubt that she or the consort she was using survived.
Kelvin thinks she fled.
Kelvin could be wrong. Remember, I rode with him. And you and I were there when you were downed and he got himself captured. That almost cost us the war.
Only because no one but his little sister thought we could win against magic. We did win. Eventually. Though it took John's lasers and Kelvin's gauntlets. It was both magic and science it won.
And the prophecy. Don't forget the prophecy.
Yes. Maybe that helped most of all.
They were approaching the side road that led to the river and Aratex. The general held up his hand and the column, that had been formed of four riders abreast, now formed itself into a column of twos. They rode on, the general ahead on his big white horse, Moore on his black horse behind him, and Lester on his roan at the side of his father. They approached the stream and started to ford it. Lester raised his eyes and looked at the sky, clear, with only a few soft clouds. There was no wind, no breeze rippling the low waters. A glob of mud hit Les in the eye. He knuckled it out and again looked at the sky. The sky appeared darker now. Clouds scudding overhead, possibly propelled by magic. A ray of sunlight fell full on the flat top of Conjurer's Rock. A dark sentinel beyond Dead Man's Pass. Was old Melba up there? Or had she turned herself into an eag-auk? Or more likely a buzzbird. He could imagine that one of the dark birds circling was her. White-capped waves formed on the water ahead of them and beneath their horses' bellies. Huge drops of rain pelted them. The wind grew stronger, stronger, much stronger. Head lowered against the blast, half suffocating in the water splashing from above and below, Lester wondered why General Brockner did not order them back. Was it because it would not look right? Was it because if they succumbed to a bluff, he and his troops and all of Rudd would be disgraced? But supposing it wasn't a bluff? Suppose old Melba meant to attack and finish them? The wind calmed, though the water continued to rise. Overhead flew a large, dark bird. Was it the witch, Melba?
We'd better!
No!
I wish your John were here to clunk the witch with a rock, Les.
Don't say that, Father! John would be sure to try.
Archers, shoot down that detestable bird!
Bows were lifted, strings drawn, and the arrows loosed. Blood and black feathers flew as an arrowhead lanced through the creature's heart. The bird plummeted, falling farther downstream. The current took it for a way and then bobbed it under. Blood stained the water where it fell. The river seemed to rise all by itself to above its banks and above normal flood level. Their horses now swam, battling for their lives against a torrential current abruptly grown deadly. Large tree branches swirled in it, joining lesser debris.
Don't leave your horse! Don't try, or your armor will sink you like a stone!
Lester tried to answer, but a huge wave of muddy water splashed in his face, nearly drowning him upright. He was all but torn from the saddle, but hung on. Other horses, other men, washed downstream, some free of their mounts. The river grew bigger and uglier than any Lester had ever seen in what he thought fleetingly might be his short life. Banks went by and leaves, and now the debris of whole trees. His roan swam for her life. Those in the column harbored no thought of reaching the other shore now, only of escaping, if there were time. If only there were still time. They had fallen into the witch's trap. St. Helens opened his eyes and found himself looking down from a height, his face pressed up against a tree trunk, his belt holding him there, his gauntlets gone from his hands and his sword missing. Down below, two men stood chained to trees, soldiers of Aratex, one of whom he was certain he recognized. Where was Helm? If they had her. But maybe she fell.
Hey! Up there! You! St. Helens! You awake?
What's it to you, child abuser?
What's it to me? I'll tell you what. When our friends get here, we're gonna chop you down. Then, after we break your arms and legs so you can't fly, and kick your teeth so you can't sass us back, we'll turn you over to old Melba for some real fun. Meanwhile, my friend Corey and I will ride after that girl of yours. We'll let her ride all the way to the border, and then we'll grab her and use her in a way she's never been used before. And if she still lives, we'll bring her on back so you can watch us do it some more.
So that smart girl went to the border, did she? Thanks. That's all I wanted from you. Now you can shut up before all that dirt in your mouth poisons you.
Big mouth!
St. Helens pushed the lever on the belt, pushed himself back from the trunk, and let himself drift slowly down. There, stuck in the ground, was his sword. Apparently, Helm had been so confident that he would wake before the soldiers got help, she left his weapon for him to pick up. He sheathed his sword, touched the belt, elevated, and locked himself on flight. He stayed low to the ground so as not to attract Melba's attention. If another whirlwind came, he'd land.
Get him! Get him!
Arrows zipped by, but they had been loosed from too far back. He twisted his head enough to see the soldiers riding hard through the forest, and then he zigzagged between trunks, finding a mere path and following it. Conjurer's Rock loomed up there to his right, far above the treetops, like a giant guardian for the old witch of Aratex. He'd bypassed that and Dead Man's Pass again, and just hope Helm roamed far ahead. His wound hurt abominably, now that the immediate threat had eased, and his head ached from its collision with the tree. He might have a cracked rib or three, too. But he looked on the bright side. He really hadn't lost much blood, thanks to Helm's tourniquet. What he needed to do was get back, get healed, and then it would be St. Helens' wartime. He'd fix that old crone, and he'd give young Philip the long-delayed hiding of his life. Yes, sir, once St. Helens got into action, the fight should be as good as won. But what about the witch? Old Melba could do a lot of damage with that wind of hers. What damage might she do with her other tricks? He contemplated the situation as the ground slid on below. Ahead, the river flowed and sparkled through the trees. So peaceful, so pretty. For the sake of safety and in hope of spotting Helm, he'd have to stop. He aimed himself at a tall mesh tree and maneuvered himself carefully into its upper branches. Poised there, he could look down at the river from on high. There, starting from the opposite bank, he saw a Rudd cavalryman, and at the head of the column, Kelvin's friends, the Crumbs. There was no mistaking more on that big horse with that big girth. That was them, all right, so Helm must have made it back. Should he go out to meet them? No, he decided that would mean a stop. If he stayed hidden and waited, the war would get started. Then he could come out, get a little medical help, get those gauntlets from Helm, and he'd be back on his way to victory. Yes, that was what he'd do. 4 black buzzvoles flew by his perch. One looked at him and seemed to wink. He watched the buzzvole fly over the advancing party. Soldiers shot at it with arrows, and it fell. Then, something else happened. The sky flew in disorder. The clouds gathered, darkening the sky. Big drops of rain fell. Lightning flashed out of what, a moment ago, had been clear sky.
Damn!
Down below on the river, the soldiers struggled with the current. The river rose with completely unnatural speed, making for unsteady going. Wind lashed cold water, flinging it on the men. The sky grew darker still, cleared for a moment, followed by torrential rain. The river continued its startling rise while the wind whipped the trees, shaking it so hard St. Helens thought he would rend apart. Branches cracked off, leaves sailed by. He hung on, unable even to see the river anymore, able to think only of himself and his predicament. He hit the button on the levitation belt just before he alighted. It cushioned his fall slightly and perhaps saved him from a broken back. Suddenly, it grew calm. The light returned. Looking below, he could see a river in flood, horses and men far downstream struggling. Some mailed vests and other bits of armor seemed bright in the sun as the soldiers wearing them tumbled over and over in the current.
Curse you, old woman!
Yes?
A dark bird alighted on a branch over his head. It looked down at him with a scavenger's bright, merciless eye.
Come back, St. Helens. Come back to the palace and your friend.
Go to hell, witch!
The bird flapped its wings and took off. St. Helens sat alone, looking out on a river and the destruction of his hopes. Far below, men struggled hard to save their lives. Was it she, or just her eyes and voice? Kelvin opened his eyes and blinked. The interior of the bandit's tent had not changed, and the faces looking down at him were the same, with the exception of the dwarves.
Well, Hito made it.
He may still die.
Look at those eyes. They're clear. He's about halfway recovered already. About all he's going to need to get his strength back is rest and food.
The dwarf? I owe him my life?
You do, unless you go ahead and die.
Better get some sleep, Kelvin. You can thank Hito when he gets back, and then, when you're strong, we'll make plans.
Kelvin drifted into a dream in which Quito wakened him to show him the pale corpse of John drained of her last drop of blood. There was blood on the dwarf's lips, surely hers. The dwarf gestured, and John was replaced by Helm, fastened to the table as John had been. Zatanna bent over her, preparing to take her blood.
No!
He sat up, his hands reaching for the dwarf's throat. The throat was there, and he fastened on it and squeezed hard.
Stop him!
Biscuit grabbed Kelvin's wrist. He was back in the tent, and the throat he was attacking was that of Hito, his benefactor.
Hey!
You dreamed Hito was someone else.
Yes. I'm sorry, Hito. I didn't mean...
I know.
Suddenly, he had his hands on Hito's shoulders and was pulling him near. His hands, almost of their own accord, reached around and patted the dwarf's hump.
Thank you, Hito. Thank you for saving my life.
It is a favor you may live to repay, as your brother would repay.
I'd like to try. You knew? No. Kyan?
Yes, and with great good fortune, he may still be alive. But it may take you to rescue him.
That's why I'm here.
We'll have to fill you in about Kyan and Lonnie and the serpents and...
Serpents? Did you say serpents?
We've got some big ones in our world, and they have silver scales on their hides. The Flop-Ears are an ancient people and wise, but once a year they make a sacrifice to what they feel are their living serpent ancestors, and...
On, and at the end of Jack's explanation, Kelvin felt he knew all that had happened to Kyan since coming here. It sounded as though Kyan and Lani must have perished, but no one could be certain. Possibly they had been taken prisoner by the Flop-Ears. More likely, they had been eaten by the monstrous serpents. But assuming the first, they might have been taken to Rofrith's palace. In fact, hastily he told Jack and the others about Helm's astral visit to this frame and how they found John Knight and Kyan in what must be Hud's royal dungeon. There was the confirmation.
That fiend putting a serpent in Smith's ear.
He was a good man. A rough man, but good. No one deserves that treatment. Kelvin, you must help us free Hud from Roforth.
I want to!
What's the matter, Kelvin? You look pale again.
I'm not sure that I can help. If I had the Muvar weapon you had and that Hito somehow used to rescue Kyan's and Lani's astral selves...
Yeah, that's why we're so glad to see you now. You're going to recover the Muvar weapon you had and show us what it is and how to use it to rescue our land.
On a fine misty morning, they rode out. Kelvin, Jack, Biscuit, and Hito. After crossing the barrens, they found a road through mountain wilderness that reminded Kelvin of Dragon Country. That did not encourage him. Finally, they reached the rim of one of two connected valleys.
This is the one. I dropped the Muvar weapon after I triggered it. The shock was so great, I never even thought of retrieving it until we were nearly back. And that tunnel, way over to the far side of the valley, is where Kyan and Lani entered.
Straining his eyes to see in the mist, Kelvin took the dwarf's word. But if he had been told correctly, and he felt certain he had, they would face Flop-Ears or serpents down there. Was he really better off than he would have been facing golden dragons? The mists thickened nearly to rain as they descended into the oblong valley. At least they would find no serpents sunning themselves today. But if they chose instead to let the rain wash the dirt off their scales... Kelvin wanted to forget the Muvar weapon and ride directly to the tunnel where sharp-eyed Hito last saw Kyan and his friend, but he knew that would not be prudent. Once he retrieved the Muvar weapon, he would feel a shade more capable. Less than halfway through their trek to the valley's floor, the vibration seemed underground. Dust belched from three separate serpent tunnels to the left of their destination.
A serpent?
Jack shrugged. This was evidently new to him.
It could have been the Muvar weapon. The serpent could have swallowed it, and the digestive acids destroyed the weapon and the serpent.
No, I doubt it. Let's wait for that dust to settle.
They waited, then continued their march. By the time the dust and vibration settled, they stood at the tunnel's mouth.
I think I should go in alone.
Suit yourself.
I'm agreeable.
The weapon should lie just beyond the entrance.
With no stopping it now, Kelvin dismounted, handed the reins up to Hito, and nerved himself to enter the tunnel of the serpent. He stepped into the dark inside, but his eyes adjusted. There, lying just beyond the entrance, just as Hito explained, lay the Muvar weapon. He could fetch it and get out of there with no trouble at all. What a relief! He took another step, bent down, and picked it up. It hefted almost the same as the laser he used to destroy so many golden dragons during Rudd's war. Yet this weapon had been made by Muvar's people, he knew, not by his father's people on Earth. That meant he held an alien device. It might not work in any familiar manner.
Kelvin?
Huh?
Then he saw her as she stepped into the pool of incoming sunlight. Covered with dirt and grime, her hair a tangled mess, she looked hungry and tired, yet as pretty a girl as he could imagine. But she looked like a girl he remembered hearing about in Rudd. He hoped that if Kyan loved this one, she was as different from her counterpart as Hito from Quito.
Lani!
She rushed toward him, dropping a sword. Suddenly, somehow, to his amazement, she was in his arms.
Oh, Kelvin! Kelvin, how I hoped you would come!
Where is Kyan?
The Flop-Ears have him.
She wore gauntlets that looked exactly like those Kyan took from the Muvar chamber. He touched the one on her right hand.
These are Kyan's?
Yes, Well, yours now. Yours to use to rescue us. To rescue Kayan.
He put down the weapon and drew on the gauntlets. The gloves felt right, adjusting immediately to his hands. But they tingled as soon as they were on. That tingle meant danger. He snatched up the weapon from the floor. He wondered as he did so whether he should instead have drawn his sword. Very near, just outside the tunnel, a great silver head broke the ground. Huge serpent eyes bored at those outside, freezing them all. Jack, Keto, Biscuit, and the four horses. All of them stood motionless as statues. The stare penetrated past the group outside and into where Kelvin and Lonnie stood. Something tingled in him and ran all the way from his brainstem down his spine. Kelvin could not shift his eyes to look at Lonnie. He could not change any part of his position at all. What awful power in that serpent's gaze! The silver body undulated and the great head passed under the high entrance. The stench was something he had never smelled before. Standing there, paralyzed, helpless as he had ever been in his life, he remembered the dragons. The gigantic serpent mouth opened. For the second time since coming to this frame, Kelvin tried to accept the certain knowledge of his death.